Hi, it's Terry Gross. I'd like to know more about you and why you listen to podcasts. And now there's a good way of letting me know by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey. Podcast survey is one word. It takes less than 10 minutes, helps support the show, and helps us figure out how we can better serve you. So that's npr.org/podcastsurvey. Thanks so much. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, historian Henry Louis Gates. His new book is about Reconstruction, white supremacy, and the rise of Jim Crow. He says white supremacy wasn't born during the era of slavery. It was born after the slaves were freed, and white Southerners were looking for ways to roll back the newly acquired rights of African Americans.
It was as if the genie had been let out of the bottle, and the white supremacists, the neo-Confederates, the former Confederates had to figure out how to put it back in.
Gates also hosts the PBS genealogical series Finding Your Roots. And we'll hear from comic Rob Delaney, co-creator and co-star of the comedy series Catastrophe, about two people who decide to marry after their wild six-day fling leaves her pregnant. He'll talk about being funny even when life isn't. The white nationalist movement of today has my guest, historian Henry Louis Gates, looking to the past for the roots of white supremacy. His new book is titled Stony the Road: Reconstruction, White Supremacy, and the Rise of Jim Crow. It covers the period after the Civil War, when new amendments to the Constitution enshrined rights for African Americans. And it covers the period that followed, known as Redemption, when white Southerners found ways to roll back those rights. He also writes about the cultural and artistic Black Renaissance of the early 20th century. Included in the book is a series of visual essays containing racist images of those periods from ads, flyers, posters, playing cards, songbooks, and more. The book is his companion to the new two-part PBS series he hosts, Reconstruction: America After the Civil War, which airs April 9th and 16th. Gates also hosts the PBS genealogical series Finding Your Roots and is a professor at Harvard, where he directs the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research. Henry Louis Gates, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back on our show. Part of the reason why you wanted to do this book is that Reconstruction and Redemption, the period that rolled back the gains of Reconstruction, seem particularly relevant to you now. Why?
Reconstruction was a period of 12 years of maximum Black freedom, followed by an alt-right rollback. What's that sound like? What's that remind you of, right? Dylan McGee and I, my partner, had a list of three Black history series that we wanted to do for PBS. One was on the Black church, one was on the Great Migration, and one was on Reconstruction and Redemption, the official name of the rollback to Reconstruction. And we had decided to start with the Great Migration. And then Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. And I realized that what we were seeing, what we were witnessing, was Reconstruction Redux. The period of Black optimism and Black hope, when we thought that, you know, even for a time, scholars fantasized that we were at the end of race and racism. You remember that at the beginning of Barack Obama's presidency? All of that was followed by an alt-right rollback and the rise of white supremacy. And that's exactly what happened in the period immediately following the Civil War. Between 1865 and 1877, when Black people experienced more freedom and more rights than at any other time in American history. 80% of all the eligible Black men in the former Confederate states registered to vote. And in 1868, 500,000 cast their votes overwhelmingly for Ulysses S. Grant. And the irony is Grant only won the popular election by just over 300,000 votes. So historians said quite accurately that Black men actually elected a white man president of the United States, Ulysses S. Grant. This is 3 years after the end of slavery. And in South Carolina, which was a majority Black state, they actually had a majority of Black members of the South Carolina House of Representatives.
And the South wouldn't stand for it.
Not the South wouldn't stand for it.
That's where there was the rollback. Yeah.
That was the rollback. And remember, there was that pesky problem of who was going to pick all that cotton. Cotton remains the most profitable United States export all through the 19th century, well into the 20th century, through the 1930s. And slavery was based around the profitability of exploiting free labor. So if you had to get rid of slavery, if you had to abolish slaves, if you had to abolish such a large source of your profit, what are you going to do? You're going to reinstitute a form of neo-slavery. And that's exactly what happened. Redemption, the rollback to Reconstruction, unfolded on two planes. One was political, and that was disenfranchising black men who had been allowed to vote because of the Reconstruction Act initially in 1867 and then the 15th Amendment. And then secondly, instituting a system of peonage and sharecropping, which is as close to slavery as you can get without actually being slavery.
Some of your book is told through some of the images and sheet music and books and posters from the Redemption era when rights were being rolled back, when black people's rights were being rolled back. And I'm wondering, are a lot of those images from your personal collection?
I happen to be my day job is I'm a professor at Harvard. And one of my jobs at Harvard is to be the director of the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research, which houses a big project called the Image of the Black and Western Art Project. And it's comprised of 26,000 images of black people in Western art, starting with the ancient Greeks and Romans. But part of that collection is also these horrendous stereotypes. And these images proliferated in the 1890s in advertisements, trade cards, postcards. And one of the favorite subjects was Sambo. Extremely black skin, exaggerated features, huge red lips, and the whitest of eyes. And these images took every pernicious form that you could possibly imagine. And they were the visual counterpart of disenfranchisement.
You have an image of Jim Crow in your book, and this is, you know, he's an African-American dancer who
right.
was portrayed by a white comedian named Thomas Dartmouth Daddy Rice.
Right, that's from the 1830s. So Jim Crow was born as a figure, a parody of black people at the height of slavery in the 1830s. And somehow that figure of Jim Crow came to be used metaphorically for the system of the separation of the races after Reconstruction.
I was wondering, like, how this stereotypical image of this fictional character, Jim Crow, became the words that were used to define the segregated South and that were used to define the laws that officially segregated the South.
I have never read a simple explanation that connected the figure of Jim Crow to the concept of Jim Crow segregation. So I don't know, maybe some scholar knows why in the world that some white supremacists use this as a metaphor, but that's the metaphor that was used.
So, you know, the performer who did the character of Jim Crow performed it in blackface. It was a white performer performing in blackface. So I couldn't help but wonder what you made of the whole, like, Virginia scandal where we learned that Governor Ralph Northam posed in blackface for his medical school yearbook photo, or at least he included a photo of him in blackface. And then the attorney general of the state, Mark Herring, admitted he'd been in blackface. Did you know that this kind of thing was still going on, even though it might be in a different form than it was in the 1800s and early 1900s?
After I graduated from Yale, I went to graduate school in England at the University of Cambridge. And there was, this is 1973. And still then, there were quote-unquote blackface minstrels performing on campus in student groups, and there were blackface minstrels performing on stages in London. And I was shocked. So if you could imagine, if I was shocked in 1973, how I felt realizing that there were, even later, even today, that there are forms of minstrelsy being performed. Why would someone who's a medical student feel compelled to put black coloring on his face and posed with a Ku Klux Klan figure at a costume party. I mean, it's racism pure and simple.
So when Jim Crow segregation becomes the law of the land in the South, you need arguments to justify it. And, you know, one of the arguments that was used to justify segregation was that, well, you know, black people are subhuman. In fact, I mean, they're not even human. They're from a different species altogether. So among the, like, pseudoscientific arguments that are made for the supremacy of white people and the subhuman characteristics of black people is studying their foreheads, studying their skulls, and having these, you know, these pseudoscientific explanations for how skull size correlate with intelligence or lack of intelligence. Can you talk a little bit about that pseudoscience and how it figures into our American history?
Well, it's called craniology, and it was thought that the size and shape of the skull reflected the degree of intelligence within. But that science starts in the late 18th century and early 19th century, and it's taken quite seriously, but now no one would take it seriously. And out of that developed race science, bad race science. It has a long and tortured history in the West, and particularly in the United States, and it was drawn upon at any given point to say that Africans were by nature fundamentally different and created to be slaves, because either they weren't descended from common ancestors like Adam and Eve, if you want to go with the biblical interpretation, or in terms of human evolution, that we weren't all descended monogenetically, that we were descended polygenetically, that basically there was a black Adam and Eve, and there was an Asian Adam and Eve, and there was a European Adam and Eve. And on the great chain of being, Europeans were always on the top shelf, and Asians were on the second shelf, and people from the subcontinent, Indians, were on the third shelf, and the fourth shelf would be Native Americans. Who was always at the bottom? Africans. And what kind of being was under the Africans on the great chain of being? Apes. So this discourse was designed to show that Africans were separate from Europeans and indeed the rest of the human community, more related to the animal kingdom. And you find metaphors of animalism being used to describe people of African descent all through the 18th and 19th century. But I can't stress enough that this discourse has an economic basis, that it didn't just come out of the air. It was used as a justification for the slave trade. It was used so that the people who shipped 12.5 million Africans across the Atlantic Ocean between 1514 and 1866 could sleep at night.
You have some lynching postcards in your book, and lynchings had been like public spectacles where people like picnicked and watched and bought souvenir postcards of lynchings. In the archive that you oversee at Harvard, is there a big collection of these?
The biggest collection of racist memorabilia in the United States is at Ferris State University. And some of the images, when you look at the credits, some of the images we use in the book come from that archive. Some are from my own personal collection, and some are from the collection that we have at Harvard. But many people collect these images. Between 1889, I think, and the late 1930s, officially, there were 3,724 lynchings. Many of them were photographed, and some were used for commercial purposes, so that you could actually go into a drugstore and buy a lynching postcard and say, having a good time down here in Galveston, Texas. It's disgusting. I had difficult decisions to make when I had to decide which images to include and which not to include. I remember,
because they're just too horrible to include.
They were too horrible. In the original formulation of the book, it took a long time for me to decide not to include it. But I included a visual essay on racist images of President Obama. And I thought about it, and I thought, I mean, if you go to Ferris State University, to the Jim Crow Museum, they have a whole wing dedicated to images, racist images of President Obama. But the point was that they are tying into themes and tropes that have a long independent history. It didn't matter who the black person was. It could be Frederick Douglass. It could be Barack Obama. They would just substitute one black person for another. And I woke up one night and I thought, you know, this is just too much. These are too real. White supremacy is too vibrant, too vital. And there are people walking around today who really saw Barack Obama through those images, through those lenses, and see other African Americans through those lenses. And I'm not going to include that. And I decided to take it out because it disturbed me. But you can find these images all over the internet. It's just that I didn't want to gather them in one place in this book.
I think also a difference might be the images that are in your book are from like 100 years ago. So
right.
You can see them in a historical perspective, whereas Barack Obama is still very much alive. He's still being very much demonized, and it's dangerous for somebody to be demonized like that. So it strikes me as a different kind of decision. In other words, I'm trying to basically say, I really understand why you would put in racist images from the past in your book, but choose not to include racist mm-hmm. images of Obama.
No, I'm glad that you agree. And it was the right decision. Now, you know that the book is dedicated to the innocents who were martyred at Mother Emanuel Church under the leadership of Reverend Clementa Pinckney. And I did that because, one, I did the last major interview with Clementa Pinckney for my film, Many Rivers to Cross. And two, because when I first heard about it, I thought, well, this guy was just deranged. But then when Roof's opinions about race were being reported, I thought, my God, you know, that this guy was playing out these white supremacist fears and fantasies that had been hatched in the rollback to Reconstruction, and those which had been reformulated from things that Hume and Kant and Jefferson and Hegel had said in the Enlightenment in the early part of the 19th century. Then I'm trying to say that I didn't know that the tenets of white supremacy were still in the cultural DNA of the United States to the degree that would lead a man to come into a church on a Wednesday night, pray, and watch people pray for an hour, and then systematically murder them in the name of these same tenets of white supremacy.
The title of your book, Stoney the Road, comes from a line in the Black National Anthem, Lift Every mm-hmm. Voice and Sing.
I'm so old, we call it the Negro National Anthem. And I insist that's the name of it because that's what my mama told me to call it.
It's such a beautiful song. There was one of the radio shows on the jazz station in New York when I was in high school used to use that as, I think, the closing theme mm-hmm. of the show. So I used to tune in a lot of nights just to hear that.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
It's just
such a great... But anyways, I think most people know the first verse better than the verse that you take your title from. So do you want to quote that verse for us?
Now, you want me to sing it or you want me to recite it?
Would you sing it?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm in voice.
That would be great if you sang it.
Okay, it goes like this. Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod, felt in the day that hope unborn had died, yet with a steady beat have not our weary feet come to the place on which our fathers sighed.
Well, thank you. That's more, way more than I hoped for. Thank you for actually singing that. What role has that song played in your life?
Well, the song was written to inspire young Black children at a time when there was nothing on the horizon that was inspirational, nothing that would make Black people think that the rights our people had been given by the amended Constitution in the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments would ever come back. Because starting in 1890, those rights had been chipped away by the redemption governments in the former Confederacy. So that the fact that our people never gave up hope, that we never stopped believing that a better day was coming, and that if we worked hard enough and prayed hard enough and believed deeply enough, that one day the glories that we saw in Reconstruction would return. And hope against hope, that's what happened.
Before we have to end, I'm wondering if you hear any other echoes of Reconstruction or of Redemption, the period of the rollback of rights for African Americans, if you hear any echoes of that today.
The issues central to Reconstruction, and let's think about them, citizenship, voting rights, who has the right to vote, who has the right to be a citizen, terrorist violence, the relationship between economic and political democracy. Those issues continue to roil our society and our politics right now. Understanding what happened in Reconstruction will help us understand how to keep the rights that we have accrued from being dismantled all over again by the evils of white supremacy.
Henry Louis Gates, a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Henry Louis Gates is the author of the new book, Stony the Road, Reconstruction, White Supremacy, and the Rise of Jim Crow. It's his companion to the new PBS series he hosts called Reconstruction, America After the Civil War, which airs April 9th and 16th. Gates also has a new book for young adults called Dark Sky Rising, Reconstruction and the Dawn of Jim Crow. After we take a short break, we'll hear from comic Rob Delaney, co-creator, co-writer, and co-star of the comedy series Catastrophe. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Sub-Zero Refrigeration, Wolf Cooking, and Cove Dishwashing. Here's head demonstration chef Joel Chesbro on the benefits of gathering around a common table.
One of the beautiful things about being a chef is that I can use those resources to bring people together around a delicious meal. This is what food does. Allow you to have these wonderful moments of human interaction.
Cook, create, and live deliciously with Sub-Zero Wolf & Cove. Visit subzero-wolf.com.
Our next guest is comic Rob Delaney. He co-created, co-wrote, and co-stars in the hilarious series Catastrophe. All the episodes, including the fourth and final season, are now streaming on Amazon. In the first episode of the show, an American man named Rob meets an Irish woman named Sharon at a bar in London. They have a six-day fling that becomes serious very quickly when Sharon finds out she's pregnant. Even though they hardly know each other, Rob moves to London so they can try to raise the child together. The series follows them as they get married, have children, lose parents, all the while trying to stay together, remain romantic, and not kill each other. Sharon is played by Sharon Horgan, who co-created and co-wrote the show with Delaney. He first became well-known through his really funny tweets. Delaney has since written essays about recovering from alcoholism and his bouts with depression. In January last year, Delaney's 2.5-year-old son, Henry, died of brain cancer. Soon after, Delaney had to return to comedy, writing the last season of Catastrophe. Rob Delaney spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with a clip from the final season of the show. Delaney's character Rob is a recovering alcoholic who had relapsed and gotten into an accident while driving drunk, injuring himself. In this scene, he's back in recovery and is returning from a checkup where his neck brace was removed.
So all good?
Yeah, I got the all clear. Got the clean, full bill of health. You know, she even said that my weight loss has made my penis look bigger.
Did you tell her about the bed sweats?
Yeah, she wasn't worried about that.
Really? Did you tell her how it soaks the whole bed now? She don't think that's weird and gross.
She didn't use those words.
You sure with the brown thing that just grew in your leg?
First of all, it's beige, and does it bother you that I've been declared healthy?
No, it doesn't bother me that you're healthy. It's great. It's just interesting that you could spend 40 years inhaling sausage rolls and get rewarded with a clean bill of health. That's, you know, good for you.
Well, you should get a checkup.
I'm fine.
Well, how do you know? I mean, you look fine, but could be a mess in there.
What are you laughing at?
No, I'm just thinking, you know, one day each of us is going to go to the doctor and be told, I have extremely bad news.
Jesus Christ.
I think I'm going to train for a 10K. Do you want to join me?
No.
Why?
Because you fart when you run.
Yeah, well, if you ran faster, then you wouldn't have to huff them, Slowpoke.
And that's a scene from the final season of Catastrophe. And my guest is Rob Delaney, who co-stars, co-created, and co-wrote the whole show. Rob Delaney, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Many people are going to be really upset that this is the final season of Catastrophe, myself included. One of the things I really love about the show is just having Sharon and Rob argue together. And it feels so real. And, you know, these disputes, like some of the worst ones, just come out of nowhere. Like they're having this tender moment, like Rob is clipping Sharon's toenails, and then something, there's a misstep, and things just go so terribly wrong. And they're shouting at each other and yelling. And it's just, I mean, when that happens in real life, you're like, well, how did this just happen?
Yeah. Or you might even feel yourself in an argument thinking, oh, I think I'm about to do something stupid. And then you try to pull back, but you do it anyway. Yeah, it can really be a minefield, you know, even in a good marriage. And whenever people get, you know, if like younger people watch the show and think, oh, God, I don't want to get married after seeing that. I'm like, wait, why not? They're a great couple is what I think.
You have such a wonderful writing partner and star of the show in Sharon Horgan. How do you two write together?
It takes us about 4 months to write a season. And we outline like crazy people. Our outlines are very long and very detailed. Then we write a very bad first draft. And then we polish it and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And we read it out loud constantly. One thing we always try to do is have the things that we say to each other really sound like human speech. So even though we've worked very hard on them and refined them, our worst nightmare is that it would sound like, you know, written or literary.
There's a lot of sex on the show, and Rob and Sharon talk about sex all the time. And, you know, in season four, they've got two kids. They're both exhausted. They're not having as much sex. And I wanted to play a scene where Sharon's dad has recently died, and her mom has sort of started seeing a new man who's this senior citizen male model. And Sharon thinks that her mom's moving on too quickly. So I want to play a scene where Sharon and Rob are talking about this.
See, the way she laughed at his jokes, it was obscene. Who uses their tongue to laugh? What was that? Do you think they're having sex?
I don't know. Maybe. She still has her original hips, right?
Oh, God. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, we barely have sex anymore, and that's fine, but not my mum's going to be doing it more than me. Maybe this is a wake-up call. Should we start making more of an effort?
I don't know. I mean, here's how I feel about sex with you these days. On paper, it sounds amazing. But if you were to initiate it, like tonight, I'd just be angry. But I still have a fond feeling when I look at you. Maybe that's enough.
Damn it, it is enough.
You know, that's a very funny scene, and it gets to this idea that's incomprehensible to young people that, you know, there might be a time where you're just too worn out to want to have sex. And I just was wondering, you know, these conversations that you're surprised you have as you get older about things that you take for granted, and in this part, it's your romantic relationship with your partner. That just seems like an interesting issue to talk about.
Yeah, and I mean, I hope that people who have kids are still having sex from time to time. You know, we're not saying, you know, that they don't have sex anymore, but sometimes, I mean, like in real life, for example, my wife and I are both reading a collection of short stories by Lucia Berlin. And so we'll be like, you know, we can be doing whatever we're doing, folding laundry or turning off the TV, and we'll look at each other and like raise our eyebrows and be like, hey, you want to go read a little Lucia Berlin? And that's like our flirty go to bed and absolutely read together and go to sleep. And that's wonderful, you know. Yeah. So, you know, it's important to have sex even after you have kids, but it's also important to do other things, you know. And yeah, your libido, you know, waxes and wanes over the years. And personally, I'm looking forward to, you know, maybe sometime around age 70 when my libido just dies and then I don't have to be, you know, led around by it.
There's not a lot of nudity on the show, but when there is, it's generally provided by you. And
yeah, I'd be typically my buttocks. Yeah.
Yes. Were you at all nervous about being naked on the set?
Oh, definitely. But at the same time, you know, and plus I'm a big person. Like the first thing you notice when you see me among other people is he's big. And so just a big naked man is funny. And we never wanted any of the sex stuff to be, we didn't want anybody to watch it and be like, yeah, baby. We wanted people to watch it and be like, oh God, this is, because it's just like a, it's like another body function, like you gotta do it, you know? And so we just wanted it to be just generally, first of all, funny, and second of all, you know, uncomfortable slash awful. Plus, nudity can really stop a story short. If there's naked people on screen, I'm not really paying attention to the story myself. But if it's a big naked guy's hairy white butt, that's kind of funny. And so I'm happy to use my butt as a punchline. That might be the funniest naked part of a male or female body is a silly giant man's hairy white butt.
Well, I wanted to talk about your physicality a little bit. I mean, you said you're a big guy. You're like 6'3".
Mm-hmm. But I'm 6'4".
6'4", excuse me.
Yeah,
I will have to correct that. You were 6'4". But you know, you don't come across as looming or intimidating. You kind of come across as gentle and cuddly. And I was just wondering, like, if you thought about how to use your body as a comedian as you were starting down that career.
You know, that's interesting, and I sort of think about that even when I'm just out in the world. Like, I know I'm big. I know I have, like, a heavy Cro-Magnon brow. So I know I'm scared. Like, if you're walking down the street at night and you see me, you're like, oh, damn it. And I feel bad about that. So I do try to sort of counter that with my attitude. I do try to sort of, you know, project a kind energy and a, hey, don't worry, you know, like the scary package, lovely caramel center or something, you know? So I am aware of that. And definitely, yeah, there's aspects of Rob that are like a gentle giant.
I'm sure people have asked you all your life if you play basketball. On the show, there's this couple times where Sharon, your character Rob is not working and he's looking for work. And Sharon a couple times suggests that you try out to be a big and tall model. And she's like, you know, you're handsome, you're big and you're tall. So there you go. And that felt so real to me. Like I was wondering if someone had actually told you that in your life.
Yeah, twice. What happened, once when I was in high school in Boston and another time when I was going to college in New York City. Both times it was I had a friend who like worked at a modeling agency and they were like, I see the guys coming in there. I think maybe I can get you a meeting with the person. And I would be like, okay. Like I would rather do that than work as like a barback or whatever. So I'll try. And so I went in, and both times with the meeting they set up, the people were like, wait, are you kidding? Are you kidding me? And like that person got chastised for even suggesting it. So two times I went into modeling agencies and they were like, oh gosh. Hey, thank you for coming in. But turn around and why don't you walk out of here and you don't need to come back. Which was just exquisite pain, you know, like pins and needles, like behind the eyeballs, like walking out, trying not to cry, being giant, you know, probably knocking over a plant on the way out. Yeah, you know, just awful. So I'm glad that when we did have him finally go into one in the third season, I think we did do a good job of conveying the utter horror of what that felt like.
Yeah, he certainly tucks his head and
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger recorded with comic Rob Delaney, the co-writer and co-star of the series Catastrophe, which is streaming on Amazon. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment at your convenience. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com/freshair to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another. March was Women in History Month, and we've declared April is Women in Comedy Month. Kicking it off from the Netflix series Russian Doll, we've got actor Greta Lee and co-creator Leslie Headland, plus Retta from NBC's Parks and Recreation, and many more. Start listening this Friday.
Let's get back to the interview our producer Sam Brigger recorded with Rob Delaney, co-creator, co-writer, and co-star of the comedy series Catastrophe. All four seasons are streaming on Amazon.
You were writing this final season in the wake of losing your son to cancer. And, you know, it's hard for me to imagine what that must have been like for you to be grieving for your son, but have to go to work and try to find humor in the world. Can you just talk a little bit about what that was like for you?
Sure. I only started to do the fourth season once I found out that Henry's brain tumor had returned and that he was going to die. And I knew I wouldn't start, but I agreed, you know, I signed up to do the fourth one, knowing I wouldn't be able to really begin until after he did die. And the reason I did that was because I have two other kids and we have a third now. My wife was pregnant when Henry died. And I just wanted my kids to see their dad go to work, really. I didn't want to do anything. I still often don't. But I love my other kids and I love my wife, and I knew I had to sort of create some sort of scaffolding in my life that would keep me going and help me sort of fake it through, and then maybe, you know, approximate normal behavior and maybe occasionally feel somewhat normal. And it was hard. It was very hard at first to come in and work. Gradually, I started to enjoy it, and I found grief and work to be compatible. And I didn't mean that I in no way was it a distraction from grief. I don't know that I could distract myself from the grief of losing a child. But it did sort of, like, the way that I've been doing grief is I must, you know, remain sober. I've been sober for 17 years. I must, if I'm not sleeping, I still have to be in a bed for 7 or 8 hours a night. I force myself to eat. My wife and I force ourselves to go on the odd date so that our kids have, you know, their parents have a relationship and they know who each other are so that they can lean on us. So so work was a part of that. Because I needed to put a support system in place so that grief could work through me and not kill me, you know? Because if you lose a child, you know, part of you is like, oh, well, why the hell am I here, you know? Because parts of me wish that they were dead and wish that they were with Henry, wherever he may be, you know? Like, I don't fear death anymore. I'd like it to happen a long time in the future because Henry's illness and disability and death and being without him has not made me love his brothers any less or his mother any less. And I want to be here with them. But when it comes time for me to die, I'm going to tap dance. But yeah, I mean, I have like a significant portion of me is lives in another realm now, and is with him.
Did you find support in the people that you worked with on the show?
Yeah. So in the room is Sharon, of course, and then our writing assistant, Chrissy Ducker, who's also wonderful and was with us for the third and fourth season. And so I just start crying at the desk, and then they'd start to cry. And they'd sort of take a cue from me as to when we could start up again. And by doing that, by sort of grieving at work in front of everybody, I don't know, it created sort of a more honest, healthy environment for us to work in, you know? And amazingly, we were writing a comedy, a joke-heavy comedy throughout this, which is insane. I mean, I still can't believe that.
Rob attends AA meetings on the show. You've been pretty open in the past about your struggles with alcoholism, and it sounds like in your memoir you wrote about this, that you were trying to stop drinking for a while but just couldn't. And then you had this just terrible car accident where you blacked out. It seems like you would black out a lot when you were drinking. And
I did.
You rammed a car, not your own car, into a like a municipal building in L.A. And what did you break? How many limbs did you break?
I broke my left wrist and had to have surgery on that. I broke my right arm and had to have surgery on that. And then my knees, neither of them were broken, but they were the skin, they were ripped open to the bone. So I had surgery on all four limbs, but only two of them were broken.
You said you were the most messed up person in your rehab house. And so you were kind of
physically,
physically. And so you were like the mascot.
I mean, because I was the type of person you could see from across the street at night while it was raining out and be like, oh, he has problems, whereas other people might have had an easier time hiding them. And I'm so grateful for that. In fact, the line in the first episode of season four where Rob says to Chris, you know, I realized that my drinking could kill other people. That's just something I would often say when I was first getting sober, because like a lot of alcoholics, I didn't care if I died, but I didn't want to kill anybody else, my God. And so when it was really driven home for me that my drinking could and likely would kill other people, then it made it much easier to stop. I guess not easy, but maybe simple, because there was no other choice.
You know, addiction's actually a big part of the show. Your character, Rob, is recovering from alcoholism. There's a character, Dave, who overdoses and ends up in a coma and has cognitive impairment. It's the only show I know where two characters have cirrhosis. I mean, these issues, it's funny you're laughing because these issues are like taken seriously, but they're also played for laughs. And in season three, Rob is secretly drinking again. I was wondering if it was hard for you to play a character who'd fallen off the wagon.
It wasn't hard to play a character who'd fallen off the wagon. One of the things about Catastrophe that I enjoy is that since we write it and executive produce it as well, which means like we hire everybody and are, you know, really behind the look of the show and the music and everything. So we're always thinking about so many things. So when we finally go to shoot it and we put on our acting hats, if I'm in a scene of a show that I wrote and also produce, and I'm playing anything, it doesn't matter if I'm pretending to be weeping while drunk and begging our babysitter to forgive me for something, or I'm going into a store and buying a bag of potato chips, I'm constantly thinking of things like, okay, we've got this much daylight left. Here, you know, it would be a good cut opportunity that we didn't think about earlier. Or be like, you know, there's kids in the next scene, so I should probably finish this one up early so we can get to that one so that because kids can only work a certain number of hours a day. And all that stuff I find really useful as an actor because it makes me way less precious about my performance. You know? So I try to fully inhabit it and believe what I'm doing and stuff, but I'm also thinking so much about the bigger picture that I don't really stress out terribly. And I think that might be good.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger recorded with comic Rob Delaney, the co-writer and co-star of the series Catastrophe, which is streaming on Amazon. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at fordfoundation.org.
Auditioning for the Netflix reboot of Queer Eye was kind of like trying out for a boy band.
Oh, it was an audition for a boy band. Like, they brought 200 gays in a room and were like, fight!
Promo Brown on the Fab Five. This week on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Let's get back to the interview our producer Sam Brigger recorded with Rob Delaney, co-creator, co-writer, and co-star of the comedy series Catastrophe. All four seasons are streaming on Amazon.
You grew up in Marblehead, Massachusetts, and went to NYU to get a degree in musical theater. It sounds like, though, when you were in college, you decided that what you really wanted to do was stand-up comedy. Do you remember your early routine, like some of your first jokes?
Oh, God. I mean, the first time I ever did stand-up, I mean, just abysmal. Mm-hmm. I can remember going to an open mic, and I had, like, an atlas with me, and I held it up and pointed to Greenland, and I noticed that – I don't know what language they speak in Greenland, but there's a native name for it, which is, like, Kalit Nunat or something is what it looks like phonetically. And I literally, like, pointed at the atlas on stage and then handed around. It was like, oh, that's crazy that it has a different name, and it's funny to me because I don't know what it is. And people were like, what is – get off stage. How dare you? How dare – it's worse enough that you stole my money to see this, but you stole my time. And people were rightfully angry, and so I was very, very bad, and then slowly got less bad.
So your career really took off because you started posting jokes on Twitter. Do you remember, like, how or when your account started becoming really big and what one of those first jokes were that hit an audience?
This is, like, sexual, but it's not – you can say it on the radio, I think. I think I said something like, sometimes if I get home from work before my wife does, I can get paralyzed deciding whether to masturbate or eat a whole pizza. And I remember people being like, hey, that was funny. And, and you know, retweeting it. And or like, I just did something like, you're damn right I'm still gardening. The constant gardener too. You know, whatever. Garden Zone. And so just crap like that. And yeah, gradually people started to pay attention. And the reason I used it exclusively for jokes was because I was trying to get hired as a late night writer. Mm-hmm. So I was submitting joke packets to Jimmy Fallon, Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Kimmel, Chelsea Handler, and just trying desperately to get work as a joke writer. So Twitter worked pretty well for that. So I think I sort of hit Twitter with the right mindset at the right time that I was able to get enough followers that I was then able to say, like, hey, Bloomington, Minnesota, I'm coming to do stand-up, and then be able to sell enough tickets to justify it and stuff. So yeah, Twitter was very helpful to me.
Did you, like, used to assess, like, how your jokes did, like, what kind of jokes worked best on Twitter and things like that, or did you just try to
only the way that an insane, sad scientist would? Yeah, yeah, only at that level of microscopic detail, like a real basement-dwelling psychopath. Yeah, so not much.
You moved to London to do the show, and do you think the UK audience responds differently to the show than the American one?
Not anymore. I think in the beginning, when we would really put Sharon and Rob through the paces, there's a more sort of fatalistic streak in British people, or a more resigned quality where they'd be like, oh, yes, of course, another terrible thing has happened. Yes, why would we have expected otherwise? Whereas in America, people would be like, what? I tuned in for a sitcom. They can't do that. They're yelling at each other at the end. It's the last episode. Why aren't they tying it up in a bow? And but now, four seasons later, Americans, they now know how we operate. So there's more, I'd say, parity in the response between the two places.
Rob Delaney, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for everything. I appreciate it.
Rob Delaney is the co-creator, co-writer, and co-star of the comedy series Catastrophe. All four seasons are streaming on Amazon. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll hear the interview I just recorded at a live event with Yannick Nezet-Séguin, the new conductor of the Metropolitan Opera and the conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra. He's a charismatic young conductor leading two institutions with extraordinary histories. I think you'll love hearing him talk about music and conducting. I know I did. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Before I say goodbye, I want to remind you that it would be super helpful if you let us know something about you and how you use podcasts. I'm hoping you'll complete a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey. It takes less than 10 minutes, helps support our show, and helps us figure out how we can better serve you. So that's npr.org/podcast survey. Podcast survey is one word. Thank you.